Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 43. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Jeff Yeager, the ultimate cheapskate. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It is not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone, but not enough for anyone's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre, and I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, to live justly, and to celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video, and links are given in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. I'm glad to be with you today from Paso Robles, California. My guest, Jeff Yeager, spent 24 years working as a CEO and senior executive with national nonprofit organizations in Washington, D.C., before launching his career in 2004 as an author, public speaker, and media personality. Specializing in an offbeat blend of original humor and practical advice for living a better life by spending and consuming less, Yeager was dubbed the ultimate cheapskate on the NBC Today show. Yeager's first book, The Ultimate Cheapskate's Roadmap to True Riches, a practical and fun guide to enjoying life more by spending less, was published by Random House Broadway Books in 2008. Roadmap is currently in its sixth reprint and was the number one personal finance book on Amazon.com. His second book, The Cheapskate Next Door, The Surprising Secrets of Americans Living Happily Below Their Means, was released in 2010. And since then, he has written How to Retire the Cheapskate Way, The Ultimate Cheapskate's Guide to a Better, Easier, Happier Retirement, and the e-book Don't Throw That Away, 1001 Ways to Reuse Your Stuff. He produces The Cheap Life, a regular YouTube video program in conjunction with the AARP, the American Association of Retired People. In 2004, at the age of 46, Yeager realized something startling. Because of the experience he gained as the self-proclaimed titan of tightwads in the nonprofit sector and the positive impact those same management techniques had on his personal finances, Yeager realized that he had reduced his dependency on money to the point where he could retire. Or rather, as he likes to say, become selfishly employed, free to pursue whatever interests he chooses without inordinate worry over a paycheck. Since leaving the workaday world, Yeager has done just that. As an active volunteer, Yeager serves on the boards of four nonprofit organizations involved in the education and the environment. But most of all, Yeager has used his newfound financial freedom to pursue his passion for writing and multimedia journalism. Jeff currently lives just outside of Washington, D.C. with his wife, Denise. He grew up in rural Ohio and is a summa cum laude graduate of Bowling Green State University, and he was voted funniest student in his fourth grade class. Award-winning short stories by Yeager currently appear in numerous books, and his recent speaking engagements have included a wide range of nonprofit, governmental, and corporate groups, as well as colleges and universities. He proclaims, "What I really believe, living on less is a good thing to do. It's the only financial advice that will work for almost everyone. It's about a quality of life you cannot buy, a sense of satisfaction you cannot fake, and an appreciation for others that gives life value. It's also about helping to save the planet and sharing with those in need. Living on less can be funny, but it's not a joke." Here's Jeff. Jeff, you have been cultivating this persona of the ultimate cheapskate for quite a while.
Yes, I have. I recently celebrated my 10th anniversary as a full-time cheapskate. And by that, I mean I dropped out of the workaday world 10 years ago last summer and started to write about how to enjoy life more by spending and consuming less. And that's led to a number of different books, and I write a lot for online publications, print publications, do a lot of public speaking, and a fair amount of broadcast work. I have a weekly web show on YouTube, among other things.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I'll be sure to give those links in the show notes. Now, since Simple Living Works is a faith-based organization, we deal with a lot of people who, you know, are in churches and that kind of thing. I don't detect a faith-based basis for the work you do. And that's not a criticism at all. It's just a matter of identification. Where is the philosophical or religious base that you come from to be a cheapskate?
Yeah, I'm not a religious person. I have nothing against religion. I just happen to not practice it myself. But I think that my writing and the lifestyle I try to promote is one that really goes to issues of kindness and charity and what's important in life and what money and stuff has to do with that, or in many cases doesn't have to do with that. So when I started writing about this, it was really from a non-faith-based kind of perspective, and it still is. But much to my surprise, many of my most avid readers have very strong faith, different denominations and so on. I did a survey of them for my second book, and I found that about half of those respondents, who were mostly avid readers of mine, had very strong religious views. The other half, by the way, were like me. They had strong views about ethics and morality and treating people fairly, and the notion that living on less is a good thing to do. It makes you happier, and it's better for the world and the environment. But for them, the underpinnings in doing that weren't in a religious doctrine, and that all kind of surprised me, because I'm not a religious person, and there are some very fine writers out there, people like Dave Ramsey, who write about money and who do approach it very much from a faith perspective. So I try to be the big tent welcoming folks of all different likes. I'm an ardent environmentalist, for instance, and I write about environmentalism from the point of view of generally when you live green, you spend a lot less money. And I kind of like with religion, I found that a whole lot of people that follow and believe in the kind of lifestyle I preach, in fact, aren't environmentalists. They really don't care about that, but they walk the walk for other reasons. So I approach it a little bit differently than some writers, which is I care less about people's underpinning motivations and more about their actions. So if somebody is living a lifestyle that's easy around the earth because it saves them money or whatever, and if they really don't care about the environment, that's fine. They're doing the right thing, just for different reasons.
So do you find that some of these folks are what we would call survivalists?
I have a very broad sort of swath of readers. I have more than 5,000 so-called miser advisors, people living all around the world who keep me supplied with their ideas and stories about how they live a more frugal life. And there's a cohort of those people, but I think it's very small, who fall into that sort of survivalist camp. And I have nothing against that, but I think that that's a bit more focused. It's obviously grounded in a certain worldview, and it obviously takes people to kind of new heights of preparing for disaster and so on. And my work is fairly lighthearted. I try to show that there's a great joy in life to living on less and consuming less, and I tend to be a real optimist in life. I mean, again, for me, the decision to live on less and consume less isn't about sacrifice or deprivation. It's also not about the belief that I think the world's going to end. It's all about you know, trying to discover what's important in your life and get on with it. I believe that most Americans, not all Americans, but most Americans would actually be happier and the quality of their life would increase if they would only spend and consume less. So it's never about deprivation or sacrifice or fear or hatred. In my case, it's all about kind of the joy of living a simpler, less materialistic life, a life in which maybe you don't have to work quite so hard to amass money to buy stuff that you don't need and probably don't even want if you stop to think about it.
Oh, we just vibrate on so many channels, Jeff. This is just wonderful. Our feeling is that life is about, happiness is about relationships, not about collecting and maintaining and dusting more stuff.
Right, right. Now, as I said sort of early on in my career, I think the quote from was, I'm afraid we spend too much time trying to amass a quantity of stuff rather than amass a quality of life. And, you know, and it's shocking when you look, I'm not a social scientist, but I do a lot of research into what other social scientists are saying and so on. And of course, in America, over the past 50 years, there's been about a 1% increase in per capita consumption per year for the past 50 years. And, you know, per capita consumption is just the amount of stuff in total that we consume. So 1% per year for 50 years, a 50% increase. And there's certainly no social science that shows that during that 50-year period, Americans have become any happier or more content. In fact, statistically, during that period, we have become less satisfied with our lives, less content, less happy. I don't know that you can connect the two, but if we believe that consuming more stuff is making us happier, there's certainly no proof of that. You know, having sufficient money and material possessions absolutely makes you happier when you're at the point of abject poverty and below that line. North of that point, there's little social science that shows that it makes you any happier. And I argue, at least anecdotally, that beyond a certain point in life, once you, as an individual, have decided what enough is, enough money and enough stuff is for you, and then there's a diminished return, wasting more time in your precious time here on Earth chasing after more stuff. You know, it's meaningful to get enough, as you've defined it, but it's craziness, I think, to spend more time trying to amass more stuff once you're beyond that point. And, you know, we live, in, for better or for worse, in a culture, in a place, in a time where there are unlimited opportunities to spend our time here on Earth chasing after ever more money and ever more stuff. You know, there's nobody says there's a limit to how much you can get. You can take on more jobs, you can do this, you can do that, you can always try to get more. But again, I just try to caution people, figure out what enough is for you. Otherwise, how will you ever know when you can declare victory in the war for more and move on with more important stuff? I mean, the thing we know for sure, regardless of our religious beliefs, is that we only have so much time here on Earth. And so that's a finite commodity. So beyond the point of enough, how can you value stuff, money and stuff, more than that time? So that's the kind of thing I write about, despite the fact that my moniker, The Ultimate Cheapskate, maybe thinks, if you haven't read my stuff, people think, oh, he writes about using coupons and stuff like that. I really don't. And there are lots of good people who do that, but that's not what I do. As I like to say, Gerald, I don't write books about how to get rich. I write books about how to get happy, perhaps with what you already have.
Well, that's just so wonderful to hear. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your environmentalism. Would you say that you're politically active, or are politics not particularly important as long as we're caring for the earth?
I'm a political person. I don't inject politics into my writing, at least in the form of books and so on. And certainly my environmentalism, while not by today's standards particularly radical, does have a political, ramification of it, no doubt about that. But let me talk about environmentalism, because I've been, you know, a member of the Sierra Club since I was a long-haired teenager in the 1970s, and I still am today. But I take a little bit different course on it, one that sometimes gets me in trouble with my fellow tree huggers, which is I believe that if you're the average American, the greenest thing you can do is simply consume, and that means spend less. So I kind of take some exception with, I think it's great that the green movement is sort of becoming more popular in America, but ironically, I believe that it's becoming more popular in America by virtue of the very beast that created the problem in the first place, and that is consumerism, rampant consumerism. Now I think many people are jumping on the green bandwagon here in America because all of a sudden, there's a bunch of green products that are really cool and, oh, usually really expensive that they can go out and buy. Well, again, if you follow my logic, the greenest thing you can do if you're in typical America is just spend and consume less. I mean, Americans are 5% of the world's population. They consume 30% of the world's resources. For everybody on Earth to consume at this level, and why shouldn't they? I mean, fair is fair. It would take 3 to 4 planet Earths to support that. So, you know, there's a bit of hypocrisy among some environmentalists in America who seem to think, you know, it's all about buying these expensive green products. Here's a perfect example of a Prius or a hybrid vehicle is great because it uses less fuel. It's also very expensive, much more expensive than it needs to be. The way they managed to sell that car to the American public and make it popular was not on fuel economy. It was because it had all kinds of unrelated computer gadgets on it so that it was this super cool car for a lot of sort of rampant consumers. They weren't buying it because of the fuel economy. So while driving a Prius, you would say, is a green thing to do, statistically, it's not as good for the environment as keeping your old gas guzzler and using it to carpool in.
Interesting.
So, you know, so you look at these things and you know, it to some extent, I mean, I'm glad that the green movement is catching on in America, but I fear it's catching on because all of a sudden there's expensive, cool, green stuff to buy. And I would argue the biggest problem facing the environment is too many people are buying too much unnecessary stuff. So if you're going to remodel your bathroom, I guess you're doing it green if you use, you know, recycled bamboo toothpicks as the replacement flooring, but the greener thing to do or learn to love that linoleum that's 30 years old that's already down on the bathroom floor and just not remodel it.
Yeah, we call those workarounds.
Yeah, I mean, that's the greenest thing you could do.
Well, now, here's the thing. One of our ideas in Simple Living Works is voluntary simplicity is not a matter of living on the cheap. Now, when you say the ultimate cheapskate, that's a persona that you've developed very effectively. But it sounds to me like you're approaching more minimalism, which is kind of more the N word these days.
My first book came out, I've been doing this for 10 years, but full-time 10 years, my first book came out 8 or 9 years ago. I've been writing on and off on a part-time basis for 15 years, so well before the Great Depression or the Great Recession. I write with a sense of humor. My books are oftentimes ranked better as works of humor than personal finance books, which they're classified as. But I fell into the use of the word cheapskate. I ended up on the Today Show through a real fluke of activities many years ago, and they declared me the ultimate cheapskate. And so, you know, that brand was sort of out there in that label. And the more I thought about it was I wanted to write ultimately about serious lifestyle issues, but I wanted to find a way to attract readers into that conversation who might not be willing to have that conversation if I was the, a frugal philosopher or whatever, so I found the word cheapskate intrigued people's imagination. What's that about? And since I was writing with a sense of humor, I wanted to know that I wasn't a Dave Ramsey or a Susie Orman, a more serious, personal finance writer. So for me, a cheapskate, I've tried to define it. I don't use it in the pejorative sense at all. For me, call us frugal, call us thrifty, call us smart consumers. I like to think of the kind of people that I write about and who I generously call cheapskates are people who are the polar opposite of conspicuous consumers. They're too smart, and they have too much self-confidence to buy stuff that they don't want and don't need just because everybody else is doing it. And I don't, for instance, I'll admit that the cheapskate has a negative connotation. It's a Scrooge and so on. I don't write about those people at all. I don't write about people who are dishonest or who are misers, who are simply content on trying to build a big bank account. I write about a very small group of Americans who are the polar opposite of that. They tend to be extremely generous. One of my surveys showed they tend to give twice as much to charity as the average American. And they tend to value experiences more than possessions. And, they tend to just have figured out what's important in life, and they skip the rest. So, it has been at times an uphill battle to say, no, I'm not the cheapskate, and that, I don't do dishonest stuff. I tip fine when I go to a restaurant. I just don't go to restaurants that much. But I found that it allowed me to maybe have a conversation that if I was using the terminology voluntary simplicity, and I'm very familiar with that, and that's kind of what I do. But if I was using that label, I think that exposes you to a certain audience, and it tends to be an audience of folks who are a little bit more serious. For instance, one of the things I'm proudest about my work is my books have a pretty avid following among college students. Who said, I never read a personal finance book before, but my roommate was reading yours, and he said, hey, this guy's pretty funny, and he's a little off color in some of his humor, so I read it. So that's what I'm trying to do, is reach a different audience, somebody that you're not going to attract in with a more sort of serious brand or message.
Oh, that's beautiful, Jeff. That's beautiful. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the charitable aspect, because one of our mantras is, let's spend a lot less at Christmas time on ourselves and be a lot more generous with the needy. And it sounds like that's something that you could heartily agree with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the life that I lead. And I'm not holding myself out as someone who's noble in that regard. What I have found is when you get your own life in order and your own finances in order, and you come to grips with this notion of, you need enough money, but beyond that, you don't really need money. Pretty soon, you find yourself in a position where you have more than you need and more than you can use. And obviously, there's all kinds of people out there and causes that could use it much better than you can. So charity becomes a very easy, automatic thing to do. And I write a lot about supporting charities. And I spent 25 years working in the nonprofit sector before I became a writer 10 years ago. So I believe strongly in the good work of nonprofit charitable organizations. And I think that solving so many of the nations and the world's problems, society's problems, is not really that hard. I mean, when you take this worldview, America's an extremely wealthy nation. I mean, it's the wealthiest nation. We're the wealthiest, most blessed people to ever live. And here's a shocker. We think about the problem of world hunger and how overwhelming that is, and we all are concerned about that. Who thinks world hunger is a good thing? No, everybody thinks world hunger is a bad thing. Do you know that from a financial point of view, the problem of world hunger could be solved on an annual basis, everyone could be fed, if Americans and Europeans stop buying perfume and cologne and instead use that money to solve the problem of world hunger? So I think that puts it in perspective. We have so much wealth that even the biggest problems we face could be relatively easily overcome with modest lifestyle changes. And, I'm not a big cologne guy myself, but as I like to say, I think the world would smell a lot better if nobody used perfume and cologne, but nobody was starving to death either.
Oh, that's beautiful. I've used a number of examples like that when I'm out speaking too, Jeff. So, that's a new one on me, but that's delightful. Well, let's talk a little bit more then about where people can find you, because you have a blog. I think it's called Cheap Talk.
I write. I have a website, ultimatecheapskate.com, but I don't do a very good job of maintaining it. Although I do list my upcoming speaking events there and that kind of thing. I write a lot for AARP, and their official savings expert. So if you go to AARP's website, which is aarp.org, and search my name, Jeff Yeager, you'll find an archive of a couple of hundred articles and blog posts that I've written for them, sort of on every conceivable aspect of, both saving money, stretching your dollars, but some of the more philosophical stuff we've just spoken about. I also host for AARP a weekly web show on YouTube. It's called The Cheap Life. Just go to YouTube and search The Cheap Life. And we have 100 episodes or so of the show so far. They're really short, just 2 or 3 minutes. They're pretty funny, I think. Just giving kind of practical ways to stretch resources and, upcycling items and then stretching your money. We've done ones on supporting charity and that kind of thing. And then I've written 4 books over the past 8 or 10 years. And they're all available in bookstores and on Amazon. But as I always say, if you want to read my book, you already bought a copy. They're widely available at public libraries, so you bought one with your tax dollars, and you can just as well borrow it from there. So I encourage people to do that. Of course, my publisher hates it when I say that in interviews. They want everybody to buy a copy of their own. And Gerald, the publisher called the other day, and he said, "I got good news and bad news on your books. The good news is now more than 1 million people have read your books. The bad news is they're all cheapskates. They're just reading them at the public libraries. I mean, we've only sold like 27 copies of your books. It's not quite that bad, but."
Well, Jeff, I have to admit that this is my style, too. Whenever I find a book, a new book that I really like, I ask my local library in Sioux City, Iowa, to get it, which they very faithfully do. And then I promote it through a monthly newsletter that I send out to my subscribers in Iowa. So I'm right with you on that one. That's beautiful. Well, just so we know, please list off the titles, because some of the titles, I think the latest one is The Cheapskate is the New Cool.
That was kind of a motto for my web show. My first book was called The Ultimate Cheapskate's Roadmap to True Riches, and it's kind of an account of my bizarre little life. It's pretty funny. I think it's the funniest of the books, and it's still very popular. I'm flattered by that fact. My second book was called The Cheapskate Next Door, and while the first book was about me and my lifestyle, The Cheapskate Next Door, that's the one I surveyed over 300 fellow cheapskates, leading a wide range of lifestyles, all different parts of the country, family size, situations, and so on, to see what the commonalities were between them and sort of reveal those secrets of frugal living. My next book was a little book called Don't Throw That Away. I'm big on upcycling and creative repurposing, so I wrote a little book about that. Don't Throw That Away. It's just claims to be 1,001 ways to reuse 100 things you throw away every day. And my last major book was released 2 years ago. It's called How to Retire the Cheapskate Way. And that grew in part out of my work with AARP. And it involved extensive interviews with people at all ages, cheapskates at all ages, for how they were either able to retire young or better, or the plans they were making as young people to get on that track. So it's not a book just for retirees. In fact, it's more of a book for people of any age prior to retirement to say, hey, you know, don't be so scared of all the doom and gloom predicaments about you can never retire, predictions that you can never retire. You know, there's some simple ways that you may have more control over that than you think.
Well, I noticed, Jeff, that last November you had quite a tour of the West Coast public libraries.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, and you're in Iowa, right?
Well, I'm in California right now, but I spend the spring and the fall in Iowa with my grandkids.
Okay. Yeah, I do. I've started in recent years because I love public speaking, and I just decided, you know, let me strike out on my own and try to line up library speaking tours of different parts of the country, mostly at public libraries, some community colleges, some churches once in a while. But I am doing a speaking tour in April of parts of Missouri and a lot of venues in Wisconsin. I'd love to still line up something in Iowa, even though I know that's coming up soon. And then in the month of September, I'm doing a speaking tour in Michigan and probably parts of Ohio and Indiana. And if any of your listeners are interested in helping me come to an area and speak, that I always enjoy hearing from them. And, you know, I need to get libraries to agree to host me. And then I try to sort of line them up back to back to make good use of everybody's time and make it more affordable for the libraries.
Are these what you would call a book signing?
No, when my books come out, I do book signings that are arranged by my publisher, which is Random House. Although, sadly, book signings are kind of a thing of the past for authors. You just, in this day and age, it's hard to make them cost effective. You can't really sell that many books through a book tour. But what I found was that because my readers do tend to love their public libraries, I drew much bigger audiences at public libraries. So I do have, generally at the libraries, they say, you know, bring books with you and you can sell them and sign them afterwards. But it's a one-hour talk that I give about all of this stuff and, you know, how to live better by spending less. And I do my famous trash can autopsy, which is a trash can full of items that I reveal to the audience and talk about how they can often be repurposed or upcycled, or, you know, what those things are really costing consumers when you stop and think about it. So mine is anything but a boring PowerPoint presentation, trust me. There's no PowerPoint involved, and I think that's why it's been a big hit with libraries and why I generally have a really good response when I, you know, say to libraries in a state, I'm coming, do you want to host me?
Well, I understand what you're talking about, Jeff. When I go out and speak, I use props, too. I don't use any PowerPoints. I use props. In my case, it's usually T-shirts or other kinds of clothing. But I don't want to embarrass you, but, you know, since we're talking about it, do you have a standard fee, or do you ask just for expenses, or how do you work out those arrangements?
Well, I do a lot of public speaking at a lot of different levels. So, I mean, I do corporate events and that kind of thing too. So, my fees vary greatly. I try to give obviously libraries a break. Since I live on the East Coast, you know, it's not practical for a library in California to fly me out there. So, oftentimes, what I do is if I line up a corporate speaking engagement, which, you know, does pay your travel and a good-sized fee, then I can say to libraries in the area, hey, I'm out there. I'll, you know, do a deal with you to to speak. So I don't, my fees are somewhat negotiable depending on the size, but there has been a very good response for what I typically charge for libraries. Certainly mid-sized and bigger systems don't seem to have a problem with it. People often ask me, the Great Recession had an impact on people's lives. Do you think that will have a lasting impact and change people's attitude towards, spending and money and consumerism and happiness and all of that? And I wish it would, but I don't know that it will. And it occurred to me, you still see so much information in the media about how to economize, how to use a coupon to save 20% on this item or whatever. And I'm not carping on that kind of information. I mean, sometimes I give those sort of tips. But if there was a golden takeaway of the Great Recession, I would hope it's not gaining the knowledge to save 20% on this same old pile of stuff, but rather an enlightenment to say, do I need all of this stuff in this big pile? And so so much of the advice given about thrift and frugality boiled down to how to simply get all that stuff for something less because times are tight. And I think that might really miss what could have been a golden opportunity, or maybe still could be, to have people say, gee, even if I can get it for 10 or 20% less, or even for 50% less, do I really need it? Is it making me any happier? And so I wish there was kind of an awakening in our society on that broader point.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Jeff. One of our sayings is, you ain't a bargain if you don't need it.
Right. That's exactly right.
So what is your take on the growing income inequality that has been overtaking us since Reaganomics in early 80s?
Yeah, it is definitely a fascinating, a scary situation. And obviously, I'm not an economist. As I say, I'm just a cheap guy in rural Maryland. But I don't claim to have the answers, but I think that it is the outgrowth of just a continuum of the haves and the have-nots and how skewed money has become in society. I think people don't realize that money is such a relative thing, that what's a lot of money for one person is nothing to somebody else. And that was kind of an epiphany I had in my own life. In my final days in the nonprofit sector, I was a professional fundraiser with an organization. And for the first time in my life, I got to meet people who were fabulously wealthy. I mean, literally billionaires. And I'm not being critical of those people, but what I realized about them was that they had so much more wealth than they could possibly ever use or need, that it all just became arbitrary. And that then got me thinking a lot about this notion of having enough, however you define enough. Everybody's answer could be different. Having enough is important, but having more than that seems to me to be crazy. And I'm also struck with how, at least in America, and it may or may not be true in other countries. I am convinced it is true in America, but I don't know about other countries. But when you talk about income inequality and trying to level that playing field through some ways, statistically, my understanding is most Americans don't agree with that notion because they believe that someday they're going to be among that super wealthy class. And so they're,
and they'll also win the lottery.
So progressive taxing is a bad thing. I happen to think it's a good thing, but progressive tax structures are a bad thing in their point of view. Even though it would be of a benefit to them now, they are convinced that at some point in the future, they'll be among that super wealthy 1%. And then it will be a bad thing. And, of course, that's a fictional belief. I mean, you know, sadly, they're not. I guess sadly, they're not going. They're not going to be. So our expectations are really out of whack with the reality, and that then leads to people not wanting to sort of grapple with the social policies and political policies to try to level the playing field. I heard two kind of interesting things recently, and I don't have the sources for at least the one, but this was interesting. Somebody told me at one of my talks that there was a study, and I think it was done by Pew, that showed that on television currently, when a television show depicts the career of the careers of the characters in the show and then shows the lifestyles that they lead, in general, there's about a 25% inflation, if you will, between the lifestyle of a real-life person with that career versus the lifestyle that they show of this person on television. So, for instance, if there's a show about a plumber, they show that the plumber has this pretty nice house and has two cars and has all this. In reality, a plumber in America makes only about 75% of what it would take to get that lifestyle. So media is constantly giving us this image that we ought to be entitled to, or we ought to have this more lavish lifestyle. Of course, we make up for it by spending money we don't have because we're able to borrow the money for it. But I thought that was a really interesting observation that, you know, the police detective on one of these cop shows, you know, in real life isn't leading the life that you're showing them leading on television. And then there was a book by, I think it's called Plenitude by Julie Shore, that talked about that in the past in America, and I'm 57 years old, so I remember this saying, people wanted to keep up with the Joneses, that, you know, the idea was you measured your success and social standing by having a lifestyle that at least kept up with your neighbor, kept up with the Joneses. And now that notion is really out the window because of media. Americans now don't want to keep up. They don't care what the neighbors have. They want to keep up with the lifestyle, the rich and famous, that they see on television. I mean, that's become their pegboard for this, that, you know, we ought to be able to live like they do on television. And I think those are interesting observations about how, you know, there is this ever-growing gap between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-not, the wealth inequality, and part of it is driven all the more by the media, which shows this, you know, total disconnect with reality.
Oh, stunning examples, Jeff, stunning. Well, this has been a real joy to talk to you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jeff Yeager, the ultimate cheapskate. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to feedback@simplelivingworks.org or simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or our Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. I received a thought-provoking birthday wish from my friend Dave Zart recently. He asked me 3 questions. 1. What was the best or most rewarding part of the last year? 2. What was the worst or most discouraging part of last year? And 3. What do you anticipate in the coming year? These simple questions are worth asking ourselves each birthday, or maybe at New Year's. To read my responses on the Simple Living Works site, go to the link to responses and comments at the show notes for this episode at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Time to wrap up episode 43 of Simple Living Works podcast. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. We'd love to get to know you as a subscriber to this podcast and to the blogs we post new each week. Subscriptions are free and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe to my other podcast called The Common Good Podcast at iTunes. We do not solicit or accept funds, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-newsletter. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. Find details in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, click About. This podcast is covered by Creative Commons, non-commercial, attribution, share-alike licensed. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Others can simply live, learn to live simply, so others can live.